It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Things seem to have calmed down a bit on the streets of Baltimore, but there are lingering questions in the days since Monday when several Baltimore police officers were injured and property was destroyed during rioting during the funeral for Freddie Gray. Gray died during suspicious circumstances while in the custody of Baltimore police officers. Meanwhile, authorities have announced that a report on Gray's death will not be released Friday as planned and will be turned over to a prosecutor. Joining me now in our community broadcast studio are Sheldon Williams, a former Pittsburgh police officer and SWAT team member who, during his time with the PPD, was a rapid emergency deployment team coordinator overseeing riot control. Sheldon Williams, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tribune Review reporter Andrew Conti, who covered the Cincinnati riots in 2001 and wrote a piece looking at what we can learn from that situation. Andrew Conti, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, too.
If you want to join the conversation, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's start with a comment by President Obama that he made on Tuesday. He said that there is no excuse for the kind of violence that we saw Monday. It is counterproductive when individuals get crowbars and start prying open doors to loot. They're not protesting. They're not making a statement. They're stealing. Andrew Conti, you covered the riots in 2001 in Cincinnati over the police killings of 15 black men in 5 years. In your recent piece, you quoted a community organizer who said they did wake up the city and made the city come to the table. But can we condone what has happened in Baltimore? And if this is what happened in Baltimore, is it acceptable?
It's a great question. I mean, Pastor Lynch, the one I talked with in Cincinnati, was somebody who I had dealt with in 2001. And, you know, basically what happened there, it started out as a peaceful protest. I was there covering the protest, and it was just a few people in the street. And as the police moved in, the protesters started moving on. The crowd got bigger, and someone in the crowd picked up a sandwich board and threw it through a plate glass window. And it switched in that moment from being, you know, a peaceful protest trying to get attention to something that was violent. And it was interesting talking with Pastor Lynch because his take on it was he was trying to walk that line. You know, nobody wants to see the violence. Nobody wants to see this looting and the terrible stuff that comes with it. But on the other hand, he said that's what wakes up a community. That's what wakes up the country.
Describe the situation that you found yourself in Cincinnati because you were in the middle of it.
Right. So it started out with there had been over the previous several years, there had been 14 black men who had been killed by police often in questionable circumstances. And then several days before the protest, there had been a chase through the streets, the neighborhood of over the Rhine. And this black man who was wanted on 14 warrants, they were all nonviolent. Most were traffic violations, like, you know, not wearing a seatbelt. But the officer didn't know that. It was 2 a.m. He chased him down there. And as they stopped, the man's pants started falling down. He goes to grab his waistbands, you know, to pull his pants back up. The officer thinks he's got a gun and shoots and kills him. What happened with the protest was that, you know, I was out there on the street the night before the protesters had rallied around the police headquarters. It had been a rowdy group. They had taken down the American flag and put it back up upside down. But, you know, they hadn't done any real damage. It hadn't been violent. It felt very safe. And so it was a shock for me the next morning when, you know, I went out and I saw the same guys on the street and they were standing there and they had these signs saying, you know, honk for us if you, you know, support us. And motorists were honking. But as the crowd got bigger, then they closed the intersection. And then, you know, the police moved in the other end of the street. I got caught in between the police and the protesters. And so, you know, it's not a great spot to be. And then, you know, like I said, it turned violent. And then when it turned violent, it just stayed that way, you know, unhinged for 3 days, 3 nights. Mostly at night. And as happened in Baltimore, the same thing happened in Cincinnati. The mayor finally declared a curfew, and that was the end. And when I spoke with Pastor Lynch the other day, he said to him that was the most fascinating part because it was like everyone in the community had said, well, we got our word out there. We had our say. Now we're willing to stay home.
Sheldon Williams, what mistakes were made in Baltimore?
One clear one would be is what was the plan to respond to these acts as they begin to get more and more egregious and as they develop. I mean, the riotous behavior, it just got momentum, as Andrew was saying, that how the start of that stuff happens. And then when you start getting momentum, what's the plan for it? And so one of the mistakes that I would say is that not having a firm plan. And I think the sensitivity that was there because of the situation, it was calling people out to protest. I think there is a fine line that law enforcement has to walk also. You don't want to be too aggressive just because people are out beginning to verbalize their disdain for the situation. But also, where is that line drawn where you now need to restore order? And so I think if you're going to stall at all, and if you're not going to have a good plan, then that permits this type of activity to grow to the level that we saw it. And so, you know, not every time, you know, when you have situations that can rapidly evolve and then grow out of hand and not have a plan to address it, then you'll see the longstanding issues of how do we then recover? How do we stop that? And you can see it prolong past the point where you would really want to desire or really want to desire. So I think one of it is, you know, there was a stalling point. And for me, clearly, the statement that the mayor is being criticized for when she says we're going to give space to this. I mean, if you look at it in retrospect, I could see where this could cause a huge problem. One, if you're going to say that to officers who are ready to establish order, they're ready to maintain order in a community, and they hear a leader now say something to that degree, they're probably asking themselves questions like, we have clearly have violations that are going on where people are into streets or whatever, even if we're going to give space, but you should frame that. And I don't think it was framed well. And so in that statement, did it imply that we're going to permit activity to continue? I don't think it was her intent to do that. But what's verbalized is that you pause people. Did the police pause? I believe absolutely they did. And not knowing that they had the authority to go in, what lines of authority do they have? What are the rules of engagement in regards to these individuals who are beginning to protest and verbalize? And when that switches over to type of behaviors that are now dangerous to not only the protesters, but to the public, are you ready to be dispatched to be able to handle it? So that was one clear issue, is that if you're going to express that, whether implied or direct, when you say or do that without a clear plan, it makes people pause. And in that moment of pause, that space, things can get rapidly out of hand.
412-246-2002 is the number to call if you want to take part in our conversation. 412-246-2002, the email address ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, we are talking about the questions in the wake of the rioting in Baltimore with Sheldon Williams, a former Pittsburgh police officer and SWAT team member, and Andrew Conti, who is a Tribune Review reporter who covered the Cincinnati riots in 2001. Before we go to the phones, Sheldon Williams, to what extent were those who protested violently at fault?
Well, you know, I've kind of looked at this situation, and I like to frame it like this. I think it's the right protests and wrong methods. I think, you know, you had suspicious background or some suspicious about the death of an individual, and you got some video that's swirling. So some people want to bring to light whether tactics or was the best practices used or whatever. So I think asking the questions is not the problem. So it might be worthwhile to say, hey, we're seeing a trend, or we see this, you know, quite often. Let's raise some questions. So the protest is not the issue. Getting out saying we want to bring this to light, That's I don't think that's the issue. People have the right to do that and have to do it in proper ways. The methods, I don't think getting out there and beginning to destroy property, cause injury, defiance to authority to the level where they're throwing rocks and bottles and such, wrong methods. And in that, you then lose the opportunity to have your voice heard, because nobody's going to be listening to what the message is underlying. They're going to actually be look at the activity and now be more sympathetic to the officers. If you're raising an issue with the officer and their tactics, you're then beginning to diminish what the focus is going to be, because now more support is going to be for the officers to go in to restore order, even if you're raising an issue, if it was there in existence. Even if you're raising an issue to the tactics, you're now diminishing that based on these actions. So that level of activity cannot be permitted. People cannot be permitted to do that. And officers need to be activated to minimize its impact to keep people safe, both the public, the community, the officers, and the protesters.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Steve on the turnpike toward Baltimore, who lives in Baltimore. Steve, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Thanks for joining the conversation. Good to have the perspective of someone who lives in Baltimore.
Yes, I mean, I was sitting at home. I don't live in the city itself. I live on the south side. But I noticed that when she took 5 hours to come out and make any kind of a statement, that she shows up looking like she just got out of a spa treatment and a makeup class, a makeover. And also, the helicopter cameras were showing back and forth the downtown gallery in her harbor area, that there were plenty of police down there, too. So it just seems to me that she was sacrificing the area around North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue and that area of Baltimore. She sacrificed the poor part of town to, you know, make sure that the downtown touristy area was taken care of and secured after what had happened Saturday night.
Well, you're talking about that you're referring to Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake and how she handled this situation. She has been criticized, and Sheldon just alluded to how there was an instruction to give the people that were protesting space, and she has been criticized for that. She says that her comments were misinterpreted. I'm not sure how either Andrew Conte, Andrew, you want to jump in and address Steve's point. I'm not sure exactly what Steve's point is.
One of the things
here
he brought up was the delay in getting out the information,
right.
And that's one of the keys that they were talking about in Cincinnati this week, is that there has to be immediate transparency, and the police, and Sheldon, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on it, but immediately the police have to step out and say, all right, here's what we know. Maybe it's not a perfect picture. Maybe we don't know the full story at this point, but here's what we know right now, and get out in front of this thing, because the longer you wait and the more it seems like you're obfuscating or holding back information, that's where the public really starts to get suspicious, and it starts to breed this sense of mistrust.
I agree. And also, you know, when this was not a planned protest, that people were going to march and they had permits and such. And, you know, so from its inception, from the beginning, it was an unlawful assembly. And so there is some latitude that's given to people. Police officers aren't going to go out there and say, we're going to freely allow individuals to assemble and do this, because it is an act of civil disobedience when you don't follow the laws and regulations, procedures to do these type of protests. But they don't go in and stop every one of those. There is a time where they're okay, we'll understand there's a balance between that. So when this was beginning to start to develop, that's where I go back to the plan. And if the plan was going to be, we understand we're going to safely make sure that people's protest and the voices are heard, but they're going to do it in a safe manner. This is the stuff that should have been on the front end. So then if the officers then have to act because it's starting to get out of hand and it's starting to progress to a level where they need to respond, then it's understood on the front end that, hey, we were doing this balance act all the way and not just responding and waiting for this to happen. So the plan should have been from the forward end, not go out there and say, we're going to give you full opportunity to be heard. There's a proper way that people want to, if they want to protest, they need to do it appropriately, and based on our First Amendment rights, absolutely they should be heard. But there's a way, if you're going to disrupt a flow of traffic or you're going to gather in a way, then they should follow it. And if they don't, then there's that, where that balance has to come in, where officers have to say, we'll give some latitude because it's peaceful. We say peaceful because people are just out there standing out there as a means of protesting to bring light to whatever it is, the matter that they're protesting. But then you got to be ready to respond whenever it gets out of hand, if it should.
How would something similar in Pittsburgh have been handled when you were on the force overseeing riot control?
Sure. There's been plenty of occasions where our staff, we had riot control elements ready, poised to go and respond, and the public never saw them. We had them staged in strategic locations kind of close to where some of the activity was beginning to happen, and people didn't see, whether the news or what, you didn't see these riot control elements out and actually engaged because we were just in the staging element. If it got to a certain level, then we would dispatch them. So there have been situations. I think it was I want to call it it was a May Day situation where it started downtown and some people gathered together, and it was on Penn Avenue. They begin to start amassing on Penn Avenue and start walking downtown. Well, we walked that fine line with them. And I'm going to say, I was a young officer at the time, and I kind of questioned, why aren't we moving right in to stop this? And it was one commander who told me and says that there is a balance that we have to play. We have to strike balance between permitting people to be able to verbalize their complaint in a certain way and then be able to act when it rises past that point. It was very good for me to hear that, because as we start looking at as then my responsibilities to train and to use these ride control elements, I had ride control individuals on the teams who felt we should be moving right in to go in to stop these actions. And we had to wait, be poised to be able to do it in the proper way. So if it was Pittsburgh, it's when it starts getting to a level that either A, it is becoming so disruptive that we can't continue, that balance is swayed, that we got to be able to come in and act, or the behaviors themselves on the front end are so egregious that we cannot permit that type of activity. You got to move in quickly, swiftly, and be able to quell that quickly before it gets out of hand.
Let's go to Tom in Pittsburgh. Tom, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Sheldon Williams and Andrew Conti.
Hi, love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a point here. There's a lot of talk about peaceful protests and voices. The way people talk about nonviolence today is a little bit like a vampire movie in which the undead are people who are just dead tired. Right? They're not really getting what real nonviolence is, what it was for Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Real nonviolence is not about voices. It's really about shifting the table and doing something when voices will not be heard. In this issue, a lot of times they simply won't. But it's really militant nonviolence. Is not simply peaceful protest or waving around signs. It's breaking the law, but doing so in a truly civil way with true, even absolute respect for police and others. But it really means breaking the law in a certain way, causing real trouble, but bringing the force of that on oneself. That's what real peaceful, not peaceful protest, that's what real nonviolence is. And these people don't have the option to do that. They know something like that needs to happen. And even King and Gandhi both, in a certain way, respected rioters of all people for doing something, and they would stress, and especially Gandhi would stress, but it is still far, far preferable to use nonviolence or what he called satyagraha, which is a radical contestation. It's not simply voices. It's not simply getting attention. It's not just a message. It's a radical political act.
Interesting statement, Tom. How does this relate to what we've seen in Baltimore and, Andrew, what you saw in Cincinnati in 2001?
Well, I think it's interesting with what Sheldon brought up a few minutes ago is that when you have this kind of rioting that goes beyond spreading the message to causing property damage and violence, that you know, people are getting injured, they start to lose the impact of the message. And you know, to the caller's point where, you know, the focus has to be on the message. And yes, breaking the law perhaps, but doing it in a way that emboldens your message and strengthens what you're trying to say. In this case, they lost control of the narrative. Same thing happened in Cincinnati. They lost control of the narrative. There was a moment in Cincinnati where on the third night of the protests, there was a police officer. I remember I was in the newsroom at the Cincinnati Post, which is no longer there. But we were listening to the scanner, and it comes across, officer shot, you know, officer down. And as we're sitting there listening, waiting to see what's going to happen, it turned out that the officer was hit by a bullet, but it hit his belt buckle and he was fine. And I've always wondered, and I talked about it with the pastor the other day, what would have happened if it had gone a few inches in either direction and the officer had been seriously injured? Would the city really have come unglued at that point? And I think, you know, to the caller's point, you're always trying to, as a protest organizer, I think they're trying to focus on what can we do to embolden our message, not lose control of our message.
And this point being, you know, I appreciate his perspective, but one thing that when he said that militant in their approach, I'm just careful with terminology like militant. And I believe that if individuals are going to stand up for their points, and I think there's a thing about discipline and being, you know, they want to be forth and out front about their issues that they're representing. But then you got to be careful with that militant, because that type of wording then can invoke something different. And if you're going to have civil disobedience, simply walking down the middle of a street where cars are supposed to be instead of people is an act of civil disobedience. And but doesn't necessarily mean you bring out riot control squads. No, our laws permit, our laws, state law says that if three or more individuals do certain behaviors, you can charge with rioting. You don't need large groups to get to riotous behavior. The law permits three or more because of the fact that this type of behavior just has the ability to just spur out of control and to a point where people and not only just property, but people can get hurt. So that's why you have to have the response necessary to quell that type of activity.
And are there thoughts in major cities? I'm sure that people are thinking about this now. And in Pittsburgh, you're no longer with the police force, but during your time there, I'm sure you would be looking at a situation like Baltimore or looking at what's happening in the wake of Ferguson and saying, what if it happens here? And if it does, how do we contain it? How do we react to it?
Yes. You know, one of the interesting things you said, Baltimore and Ferguson, you have Baltimore Police Department that has a larger percentage of diversity than Ferguson. And my numbers might be off a little bit, but there was a huge push up and through 2007 where that former mayor really pushed to have diversity. And it almost got to almost 50% of the police department, 43%, I think it was, of the police department. And if you look at numbers wise, I think Baltimore City currently is about 63% African-American. I think my numbers might be off. Compare that to Ferguson. Ferguson, I think, is 67% African-American, and they only had three black officers of the 53-person department. And so you look at a Ferguson issue and the riots and stuff, and you could say, well, you know, there are issues here that maybe people aren't being heard. There are no efforts to make sure that it's inclusive, that you get the issues, that they're culturally sensitive or whatever. So that's one. Baltimore, you have an African-American mayor, African-American commissioner, large amounts of African-American police officers. Yet we still have the issues where the policing community don't connect. So it's not just a quantitative approach. Got to be qualitative. And what are they doing to make sure that they're bridging the gaps? Just like Angie was talking about after these riots, what was happening with the task force coming out, seeing what's best practices changing. So Pittsburgh needs to do that. I think under this new chief and the new mayor, they have talked about it. I've participated in some things that they want to address these issues. I am holding out to make sure and see if they'll do that. I have faith that they will. I'm liking what I see, but we have to address the disparity. And it's not just putting people in positions. You have to have qualitative approaches so that the police department is not empathetic, that it feels as if the community is part of them and that they bridge the gaps that are existing so that we don't have issues like this. When they do arise, we've had already previously had connection that we can quickly get in there and dispel this, move to a problem-solving effort, and be able to quell any issues that would arise.
I mean, that's the discussion we've had in Pittsburgh, though, for the last 10 years, right? I mean, longer. How do you get more black police officers on the street, right? And it becomes an issue of going out and recruiting them, but there's also the civil service exam. And how do you get more quality officers into the force? I know that's something you've thought about. So how do you address that?
Huge issues are, you know, you got to take more of a objective approach, not subjective approach, towards hiring police officers. And I say objective, you know, because there are still elements. If you're going to heavily weight panel interviews as part of your hiring practices, and though somebody might not be outwardly racist or have these type of underlying generalizations about somebody, but when you leave that subjectivity between three people put heavy weight on that, so a qualified candidate comes before you, you say, well, there's just something about this guy we don't like, and you give lower marks, it then puts that person way down, no matter what their scores may have been. There's been talk about lowering scores so that it'd be more attractive. I'm totally unequivocally against that. That speaks nothing of the quality of officers by lowering standard. You have to have more of an objective way of being able to identify who officers are, more proactive ways about recruiting those officers, and then make it attractive to individuals to even see that a career in law enforcement could be a worthwhile career for them to endeavor.
With what has happened under Mayor Peduto, are you seeing that those issues are being addressed in a more effective way than in years past?
I think what he has done is he has identified a leader, the chief of police, who has, and I've seen him out and about in community settings, that he is intentional about hearing the community and making sure that he's addressing the needs. And so I think that's the start. We'll see. The true test, we'll see, well, where would this end up if we look at it from a longer-term analysis. We got to see how does it reflect in recruiting. What do we feel? What's the community sentiment? Not only in what the officer or the chief officer is, but its police department. Do they feel like that the police department is part of the community? But that analysis has to be done over time. I think he's making some initial steps towards addressing those, but we'll see. I haven't seen any increase, real big increase in minority hiring and diversity in our hirings as of yet, but I know that there are efforts to move forward with that, and I'd wait and see to see if we're going to be about it. We had a police chief that was black previously to this chief, and we still didn't see any real increase in our diversity. And so by putting people in positions, you got to have the best efforts to go after those qualified individuals.
And why do you suppose that was? Because one of the things that's been said is there just aren't enough minority and African-American applicants.
Yeah, one of it, that's part true. Part true to the fact that because of the history and stuff like this that continues to happen, we got to dispel this whole understanding that, that law enforcement is a great career field for people of color, for people of diversity. So that's the one issue. You have to increase the pool of candidates. But secondly, you know, you have to be able to have recruiting efforts that actually targets them, not minimizing the standards, but just qualify. You got to go to different places and recruit outside of these normal circles that we keep running around in and not seeing the pool of individuals who are coming to even apply for the test. So you have to be more intentional. Intentionality isn't sitting back saying this is what we want to do. It's action. You have to be out there doing it.
And according to the 2010 census, it shows that 28% of Baltimore's population is white, while 46% of the police officers working in the city are white, according to, again, to census data. So there seems to be, you know, if you're looking at trying to hire a proportionate number of minority and African-American officers proportionate to the population of the city, it seems, based on those numbers, that things are a bit off or a bit skewed in the wrong direction in Baltimore.
Yeah. So your stats, you're saying that could you read those stats again? You said
it was that the population of the city of Baltimore, I believe it was, it's 28% of the city's population is white. Mm-hmm. 46% of the police officers working in the city are white. So if you have 26% white population, the remaining 72% or yeah, 72% it would be are non-white.
Yeah.
But you have a police force that is nearly 50% white. So based on those numbers, can that be problematic? Is that part of the problem here?
Yeah, your point well taken. I think they're doing a better job of it than we are. And I think I don't have our current stats, but you know, it was as low as I want to say 14% of African Americans on, even though we represented
on the Pittsburgh police force.
Correct. And where we represented about 25% of the population. So there was a disparity there. Those numbers might be slightly off. The point being is that you have to reflect the community. We're about 350,000 residents, but we're about over 1.5 million strong during the day because people come through here. You have to be reflective of the community for which you're going to serve. And if it doesn't represent that, then you have to have the intentionality to make sure that you do it. And it's not just having numbers on the police department. You have to have qualitative approaches and having individuals just walking beats or starts, but they got to connect to the community to feel part of the community. And if they don't do that, all we're doing is throwing numbers out there, and we're not having any better efforts at being able to bridge the gap that exists.
Andrew Conte, in Cincinnati, the discussions that have happened, the things that have been put in place since those riots seem to have improved the communication between the community and the police force. So is it about being proactive, about open lines of communication, monthly meetings that have been established since that 2001 riot situation where you have monthly meetings between community leaders and police, in addition to maybe trying to improve the percentage of minority officers on that force?
Right. Part of it was technology. They started collecting numbers on all the stops and tracking, you know, what the demographic data about people who were stopped. Part of it was policy, the police department coming out and saying, we're going to review the way we use of force techniques and the way we deal with the public. But the most important thing, talking to this Pastor Lynch in Cincinnati, was that every month for 14 years now, local residents, police officers, the community leaders have all sat down and said, you know, what can we do to make this better? What's going on? And he said, you know, there's nothing that happens now on the policing side in Cincinnati that the community doesn't already know about before it happens, you know, before it takes place. And they also had an incident recently where there was an officer shot an unarmed black man on the street. But they came out right away and they explained what had happened and, you know, what the circumstances were. And you didn't have the same reaction. The public said, oh, okay, you know, we understand. You came forward. You were forthcoming. They've developed avenues for having that discussion that didn't exist before.
And so instead of having riots, you have people sitting back calmly assessing the situation and then reacting and parsing through information accordingly.
Yeah, because they believe there's accountability, right? They believe that the officers are being held accountable to their community. And so there's empowerment in that. And I think that that quells that notion that you want to go out and, you know, do something because you feel like the officer hasn't been held accountable. You feel like this officer is going to get away with it. So you go and you're going to protest on the street and you're going to, you know, burn down your neighborhood. And in turn, by creating these avenues where people can feel like they're getting justice through the system, it seems to have addressed those concerns.
Very interesting perspectives on Sheldon, you wanted to get one last word in.
Yeah, you know, Andrew brings up a great point about, you know, when people feel as if, you know, whether they're not being heard, they want to bring light to a situation, you know, and these things do exist. But you look at the situations like Baltimore, you know, and I'm speculating, but I think if you did a wide grab and grab four people and asked them what's the reason why they're out here looting and rioting, I don't know that they really had any type of unified voice to say, other than, oh, there's another African-American who died in the hands of the police, which brought light to this. But again, I'm going back to the message. There's people that was very opportunistic and losing the opportunity to really bring light to an issue. Were there tactics? Were there procedures done in this that caused this situation? And that needs to be assessed. And so in a protest saying, we want to make sure that there's a fair and equitable way of evaluating this, and that's why they're protesting, I think that's totally appropriate. What we saw was some of the frustration, but some of the frustration is not just in the action itself. Some of the frustration is because some of these same individuals are not vested in their community. So that's why some of this behavior of looting and going and destroying the property and stuff is because those individuals they're not even vested in their own neighborhoods. So this is just a way of acting out. It's not to bring light to the topic itself. It is them just demonstrating, because it is more indicative of a longstanding issue where individuals need to be better part of the process so that we can bring forth change, not just be out there taking opportunity.
That's former Pittsburgh police officer Sheldon Williams, who was a rapid emergency deployment team coordinator who oversaw riot control in Pittsburgh. He's now a member of the Citizens Police Review Board. Also with us, Tribune Review reporter Andrew Cotty, who covered the Cincinnati riots in 2001 and joined us to talk about his perspective on that and the lessons learned from that situation, how they might be applied to us here in Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, thank you both for being a part of this conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, we'll talk with Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls, who are performing tonight with the Pittsburgh Symphony. That's next here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It may seem hard to believe, but it's been 20 years since Amy Ray and Emily Saliers began making records as the Indigo Girls. During those two decades, the grandeur of their harmonies and their impressive catalog of heartfelt songs, including Closer to Fine, Power of Two, and Kid Fears, has earned them many accolades, a legion of fans, and now a date with one of the finest orchestras in the world, the Pittsburgh Symphony. Tonight at Heinz Hall, the Indigo Girls are in concert with the PSO under the direction of conductor Robert Bernhardt. I'm joined now by phone by Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls. Emily, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks. I'm glad to be with you.
And with us in studio is Robert Bernhardt. Hello, Robert. Good to have you with us.
It's my pleasure to be with both of you.
Emily, how did this idea of a collaboration with a symphony orchestra come to fruition for the Indigo Girls, and what appealed to you about it?
Well, we were actually invited to take part in sort of the circuit of symphony shows by the agency that hooks up the artists with the orchestras. And so we were really, really excited about the idea. We had had some of our friends doing it. Brandy Carlisle had done some shows, and also early on, Nancy Griffith had the Blue Moon Orchestra, and, you know, there were a lot with Lyle Lovett and his big band, and so we were interested in how artists like ourselves could have our music orchestrated. in a different incarnation. And so we jumped on the chance, and we've been doing it about 2 years now. And actually, our very first concert was in Chattanooga with yours truly, Bob, conducting. So now we'll be in Pittsburgh, one of the finest symphonies that exists, and we'll be back with Bob Bernhardt, and so we're excited about it.
And so, Bob, you were there on the ground floor, and you work periodically with the Indigo Girls as the conductor for these shows. Explain some of the intricacies of the collaboration and how everything is shaped.
Most of the time, it has to be shaped pretty quickly. The rehearsal time is pretty short. In fact, we have one rehearsal here. But everybody knows the territory. The crew, backstage crew, Pittsburgh here, I mean, it's top flight, among the best in the world. They know the hall. They know the sound. They know what they need. But also, Amy and Emily know what they need. So during their sound check, they get it all straight. I know what I need to hear from them while I'm conducting. So I have what I need from them in my monitor. And the best thing about it is that when they decided to do this, the Indigo Girls chose fantastic arrangers to create the charts for the orchestra. So it was an incredibly smart thing to do for many reasons, but mostly because great orchestras love to play, and they love to play music that's well crafted for the orchestra. And it's in the case of these charts, they're all great. As far as how the blend works, as far as I'm concerned, it's a complete natural. I think they would disagree probably, but a lot of their songs are created orchestrally. There's a sweep to them, especially a lot of the ballads that they've absolutely fit a beautiful string sound behind it. And then a lot of power, moments of great power with the full orchestra that maybe the greatest impact is in their original form. But when you're in it with an audience in a big auditorium, the impact is extraordinary when the full orchestra is backing them up.
Emily, how is this different from performing on a regular concert tour?
Well, it's about the only time we ever get nervous anymore, playing with orchestras. The way it is different is that we're working with, and of course the number of players within an orchestra can vary from city to city, but you have, say you have 80 players, for instance, and so you have a group of individuals that is working together, and we don't have any click track or any drummer. And a lot of times there's a latency, just a natural sound latency. It's the percussionist, which they typically are in the very back of the orchestra. And then there's me and there's Amy up front with our acoustic guitars. And so there's a bit of hold on to your hat sometimes that happens. And a lot of my charts, for whatever reason, were arranged with some syncopated percussion in them. And so those moments are challenging, you know, to keep it all together. And that's what Bob has to do. Bless your heart, Bob. And so, but that is a completely different experience from walking on stage in an Indigo Girls show where it's just me and Amy, or it's me and Amy with a band and a drummer. And it's very close quarters and, you know, almost, you know, without a thought to keep it sort of metronomic if the song calls for that. The other way it's different is that I, you know, there's one song we do that Amy wrote called Yoke. It's an absolutely stellar arrangement, a beautiful song. And I don't play guitar on it. I sing very little on it. And so I actually get to sit and or stand there and listen to the orchestra play and listen to Amy sing. And so I have this sort of like, it's almost like I'm a fan standing there on stage, which is different from having to concentrate on guitar or sing my parts or things like that in one of our regular Indigo Girls shows. And then there's the fact that, as Bob was saying, things happen quickly. Usually we don't know the conductors with whom we're working. Now, we've worked with Bob a few times, so that's a bonus because we love working with him and we're familiar now. But typically we'll get into town, we'll do our sound check, we'll meet with the conductor for 30 minutes, go over the flow of the show, just quickly discuss how the songs start and if there are any trouble spots or things to look out for. And then we're on with the orchestra for a 2.5-hour rehearsal, and then there's a break, and then there's a show. So in a sense, there's, I don't know if it's pressure, but it is just we have to rise to the occasion because things do happen quickly and they only happen once, and then it's the show. And I personally love the challenge of that, but it does keep us on our toes, these symphony shows, in a different way than regular shows do.
And what does the orchestral layer add to your songs?
Well, I think what Bob was trying to describe it, and he did so well, that it adds a richness and sort of a drama and a power. So there's a song of Amy's called Compromise that we do that's really like a punk rock song, really, or a rock song. But the orchestration, there's no drum and there's no electric guitar, and the orchestration brings that element of rock to life. But it's all, you know, strings and orchestral percussion. So that is a unique musical experience for us to have. And then for a song of mine like Ghost, where it was orchestrated on the record, but not a full orchestra, and it does lend itself to that beautiful, lush, dramatic string arrangement. So there are things that playing with an orchestra brings to the music that only that you can only have in that experience with a full orchestra. And, you know, for that, we're grateful because not everybody gets to do this. And we count it as a privilege and we take it very seriously. We work hard at bringing the best in conjunction with a group of people that we haven't worked with before. So it's neat. It's people coming together who don't know each other, making beautiful music, and it brings the songs to another level of experience.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guests are Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls, performing tonight with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and guest conductor Robert Bernhardt. Robert, does a show like this attract some segment of the regular symphony crowd? And if so, what is the response that you get?
The answer is probably there'll be some, but generally speaking, Pops concerts in general have their own audience. And there's not a lot of crossover between the classical audience and the Pops audience. We try to make that happen, but the response to the Indigo Girls shows, you said, mentioned before, that they have a legion of fans. I don't know how, Emily, the response from the fans hearing your music with great symphonies is extraordinary. It's over the top. This is one of the happiest audiences I've ever encountered. So there is that. And if I think regular symphony goers, the ones that come to the show are probably Indigo Girls fans.
And Emily, what kinds of reactions do you get from your fan base?
Well, I think it's like what Bob is talking about. They're excited to be there. And we don't play these shows every night. You know, they're more rare. So I think everybody's just excited, and they can tell that we're excited. And I think they can tell that we're really a little bit nervous. And I think they're kind of like lifting us up. And then the sheer drama and lushness and excitement of the orchestral experience with these people who know our music so intimately is a great experience for them. And I know that they sing, and even though, you know, Bob may be wearing a tux and the rest of the symphony's dressed in black, and I guess Amy and I try to dress as much as we're able to, which isn't that much. But even so, our crowd, because they like to sing along and they participate, you know, it's not, there's really no filter between us and them. And so it's kind of a rare opportunity to get a symphony experience without any sort of, it's very reciprocal. And the energy is palpable, and as far as I can tell, our fans really love it. And as far as I can also tell, those people who are just staunch symphony supporters and who love classical music and the programs that the symphonies present, they really stick it out with us. And I appreciate that because it's a shift from what they're used to in the context of hearing their symphony that they're so devoted to. So just a whole bunch of cool, energetic positivity happening all the way around.
And wait till you'll hear Heinz Hall just filled with the entire audience singing Kid Fears. It's riveting. It's a goosebumpy thing for me, and this will be our fourth time together? It's really over the top.
Will there be an Irish whistle for Closer to Fine, or will the audience be asked to supply the whistle, as I've heard Emily ask in the past?
There might be some people out there whistling, but I think they're going to be drowned out by Bob. I don't even remember what.
It's in Flute and Piccolo. It's up there.
Flute and Piccolo. Yeah. So there may be people whistling, but they might just want to listen to the flutes and piccolos that instead. But they definitely sing along, and more often than not, they'll take a verse all by themselves. And Bob is used to that. And I don't know if the players are used to it, but they're going to get to experience. So we love our Indigo Girls fans.
Emily, it's been 4 years since the Indigo Girls released a new studio album, but on June 2nd, the much-anticipated release One Lost Day will be available. What can you tell us about it and the single Happy in the Sorrow Key?
Happy in the Sorrow Key, I'll talk about that first. Amy wrote that song. It's got a nice rock feeling to it. It's very accessible. It has a nice melody, but in keeping to Indigo Girl tradition, it's quite thought-provoking lyrics, sort of a heavy subject matter. It deals with the acceptance of the impermanence of life and the good with the bad and things like that, hence the title Happy in the Sorrow Key. I love the song. We just played it live for the first time acoustically and got a really strong response to it. This album was produced by Jordan Brooke Hamlin, and she's a young woman we've never worked with before, and we recorded the album in Nashville, and we used a lot of players that we've never worked with before. So we took some chances, and we had a new mixer as well. The guy who mixed the record is Brian Joseph, who does Bon Iver stuff. So a new team, and that was exciting to take that risk and have it work out well. And, you know, we feel pretty seasoned at this point, but we also feel fresh, if that's at all possible. That's how we feel. We don't take making music for granted. We put everything we have into the studio experience, and I know it's been a long time since our last record, but time goes by so fast now. It just seems like it was yesterday. But we both, Amy and I, feel fresh and excited to take this record out. And so far, the response has been positive. So, again, gratitude to have a musical partner like Amy with whom I can enjoy this work over all these years.
Well, I know people in Pittsburgh are excited about having you and Amy in town, and we've been talking with Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls. They are performing at Heinz Hall with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra tonight under the direction of conductor Robert Bernhardt. Emily, Robert, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. And Bob, we can't wait to see you.
Back at you, Emily. Safe travels.
1, 2, 3, 4.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our travel correspondent, Elaine LaBalm, usually joins us at this time, and she was scheduled to be here with summer theater recommendations. But due to time considerations, we will wait until next week to have that conversation with Elaine LaBalm. So again, next Thursday, Elaine will be here in her usual slot talking about summer theater recommendations. She has some interesting ideas to share with you for this summer. In the meantime, before we wrap up, let's check in with Mark Neutbar and find out what's happening in the 90.5 WESA newsroom.
Paul, we've got a great series coming up next week. All week during Morning Edition, we're going to be diving into this idea of pensions. We have a lot of problems with pensions in the state of Pennsylvania, all the way from the very top down into the municipalities. And that's one of the problems is all of these small little municipalities that we all like to have in this state, many of them have their own, if not several, pension plans. And trying to keep a pension plan together for just 5 or 10 people is not always the best way to do it.
And so there are certainly some pressing concerns there. People are seeing the clock ticking and realizing, Governor Wolf certainly realizing, as he urges on the legislature, that something has to be done. So obviously a very timely series.
Yeah, definitely. We'll be talking about some of the things such as going from defined benefit to defined contribution. That will be part of it. There's a practice called spiking, where hourly employees will work as much overtime as possible their last couple of years of their career, and that increases the amount of money that they get in retirement. So all of that will be explored. Also, there are some laws on the books, but they're not always followed, Paul.
Very interesting series. We'll look forward to hearing that from the staff in the 90.5 WESA newsroom. Senior news editor Mark Neutbar joining us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Tomorrow on the program, we'll preview this weekend's Pittsburgh Marathon. The weather is supposed to be sunny and warm, and a doctor from UPMC will advise us on the best methods of coping with the weather conditions on race day. We'll also focus on the Kids of Steel portion of this year's marathon. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.